Welcome to the Kaleidoscope of Possibilities, Alternative Perspectives on Mental Health. My name is Dr. Adriana Popescu. I'm a licensed clinical psychologist and leader in the field of mental health, energy psychology, addiction, trauma, and empowerment. In this podcast, we will be exploring mental health from a variety of perspectives, from the spiritual to the shamanic and beyond. What if mental illness isn't everything we think it is? What if everything we see as a pathology is actually a possibility? What else is possible with mental health? Hi, everyone. Dr. Adriana Popescu here with you today with another episode of Kaleidoscope of Possibilities, Alternative Perspectives on Mental Health. I'm very excited to have with me today as my guest, Dr. Megan Jobson. She is an internist with specialized training in integrative and palliative medicine. She cares for people with long illness as a physician with the San Francisco Department of Public Health. Dr. Jobson earned her BA from the University of North Carolina at Greensboro, her PhD in neuroscience from the University of Utah, and her medical degree from the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. She completed her medical residency and fellowships at the University of California, San Francisco. Welcome, Megan.
Hi, nice to see you today.
Yes, so happy to have you with us. And we actually met through another former podcast guest, Dr. Juliette Morgan. And We're going to talk a little bit about what the two of you have been up to and some really cool creations that have come from that. But as always on the show, I love to start with, tell us a little bit about yourself, your story, how you came to do the work that you're doing now.
Yeah. So a little bit about me. When I was a teenager, I got sick and people in my family were also sick. And it kind of had like these mysterious illnesses that no one could, you know, I got diagnosed with things a couple of times. And those diagnoses have changed, which I think is a common thread for a lot of people who get diagnoses, especially when they're younger. And those evolved over time. And initially, I was a scientist and trained in that, and really found that I got a lot of joy from working with people one-on-one, especially as a rehabilitative Pilates instructor. And I decided what I wanted to do with my life is work more with people one-on-one, or groups of people with their health issues and just talking to people and spending time with them. And so with that, I went to medical school after doing a postdoctoral fellowship and have done subsequent training, and all that time living also as a patient identity, as well as a practitioner, and as well as someone who was a scientist and who did movement with people of all different types and abilities. And so that's kind of what's gotten me where I am today and has left me with a understanding of a lot of the injustices and inequities that exist in care. While I know now I have a lot of privilege as a person who is highly educated and is a physician myself now, I have a lot of access to things that I know I never would have in the past. And it's really interesting looking back at some of my illness experiences when I try to retell them, they don't make any sense to me because now I'm a doctor and I'm like, that doesn't make any sense. And so it's been very interesting to be trained while having an illness and see things through different perspectives and be able to put myself in those different positions from at least my experiences in all those trainings and experiences.
Yeah. And, you know, you and I spoke before and shared this, you know, I too actually struggled with autoimmune stuff. I mean, they didn't, for 13 years, the doctors couldn't tell me what was my diagnosis. You know, they gave me a chronic fatigue syndrome working diagnosis. And it wasn't until many years later that they actually found out I had Lyme disease. And I have to say, you know, my experience with kind of the Western medical treatment system wasn't super positive. I mean, I had doctors telling me my symptoms were all in my head, that, you know, it wasn't real. I felt like I wasn't being heard and wasn't being believed. And I wonder if you could comment on that, either with your own experiences or what you've heard from other patients that maybe are struggling with similar issues.
Yeah, I'll just say that you are 100% not alone. I think even as a physician, even as a highly educated physician, there's a lot of issues in our medical system, our medical training, and our medical knowledge that we need to address as the sort of community of medicine, and how we talk to people and how we communicate with people about these types of things. And I think there's a lot of room for growth there. But even myself in my position, I have been communicated with in those ways. And I talk to the person who is talking like that back to me and sort of say, you know, this is really hard for me because you're essentially telling me that this doesn't exist to you. And so kind of what's your plan? You know, I kind of call them on it. It doesn't really happen to me that much, but it still happens to me. And especially when I go into a place and don't tell them, or they don't know that I'm a doctor, or they don't know that I have science training and those kinds of things, just the way that you're talked to is completely different. And maybe not necessarily in a negative way, but in a way to make things simpler. And I think, you know, there's a lot of reasons for that. But, you know, medicine has changed so much in the last 200 or 300 years. You know, I mean, it's gone, like, doctors being an esteemed group of people didn't really exist until this, you know, past century. And the way that we practice medicine has changed and evolved over time. And I think now we're entering into an era of compassionate care, trying to find practitioners that have life experience, have experience with caregiving, such as, you know, having women as doctors who often tend to do statistically more of the caregiving, having people from different backgrounds, from different abilities, from different life experiences and walks of life, instead of, you know, when I was a kid in the 80s, doctors were mainly white males in the United States. And now that demographic is really shifting, which I think is bringing in a lot of influence of other things that we have found to be important, you know, that's all been backed up by research, that are showing us different ways to communicate. And still with all that, as long as we're controlled by, you know, a 15-minute visit model, it's really hard. It's kind of like asking your best friend to be your best friend in 10 minutes if you're having a big problem. Yeah. It's just, it's an impossible. Some people can nail it and they're great. And you go into the doctor and you just feel heard, seen, you got what you needed, you got what you wanted. But a lot of the time, it's just like communication with anyone else. There is fraught with lots of room for mistakes and errors. And I think when you have expectations going into it, sometimes those expectations are not met. And so I apologize on behalf of everyone who's had a negative experience in saying that you're very much not alone, and it's still very pervasive, and it's something that is very actively being worked on in medical training and all the way up through, you know, residency and how I work with medical trainees, thinking about ability and disability and communication ability of patients and people, you know, so.
Yeah, thank you for mentioning that. I think the whole 15-minute or sometimes less even doctor visit is just ridiculous. Like how they think that you can really, you know, assess somebody with their history and all that they have going on. And if there are communication challenges or language barriers or whatever it may be, how unrealistic that is to really provide quality care to someone in that short of a period of time. And I think it's good for the public to know that it's not the doctors who are necessarily, you know, making those short visits. It's the third party payers and it's the systems, if, you know, the doctor's part of a healthcare system, you know, that are determining that stuff.
Yeah. I don't think very many people in the world, whatever job they do, want to do a bad job at their job. Right. Or like at what their passion, you know, I think most people in medicine, at least at some point, got into it because they feel very passionate about them. It's not something you just arbitrarily pick to do. You got to go to school for a long time. You got to really push to get this degree and to get this training. And most of us are overachievers, and we don't like doing bad jobs. We don't like not being able to help people. And so I think part of, you know, what we think of as what medicine can do comes sort of from myths in our culture and, you know, our media that we're exposed to and what medicine can and cannot do. And many of us go into medicine because we watched ER or Grey's Anatomy or whatever. It influences us. It influences many people in ways they may or may not be aware of. And then when you actually get to the meat of what being a physician is, it's very different. And that's shaped by, you know, the model that we live in, the capitalist model of insurance companies dictating these things in the United States. And whether or not you agree with that is not really the point, but the direct result of that is that our time is short and we are there. The goal is to make the most money, the most units of care, and sell the most medical tests and everything like that. And of course at academic institutions where we train, those things are not stressed, but once you go out and get a job, especially in the community or private practices, those things are really important to the bottom line of whether or not people can practice. But I think in general, that's why I trained in integrative medicine and palliative care, because I can spend, you know, 2 hours on an intake and an hour for every additional appointment and get paid for that. And I really value that time. That time is completely essential to understanding who the person is in any way before I can kind of give them advice.
And yeah, I wanted to ask you about that specifically, integrative medicine. This is another trend. You know, you mentioned that things are starting to change, including at the training level when people are in med school. And then there's a sort of this field that has been emerging more recently that I see with integrative medicine. Can you tell us what that is exactly?
Yeah, integrative medicine. I think if you ask, you know, 10 people what that is that are doctors, they'll give you a different answer. But it's a it is a fellowship that you can do after many different kinds of residencies. So I'm an internal medicine residency trained, but we have people who are in emergency medicine, radiation oncologists, people who have done other specialties, like I also did palliative care, people who've done oncology, psychiatry, anything. We have surgeons, urologists, all of these things, because what they realized was that the biomedical model, which is the standard model that I think we can say is surgery and prescription medication driven, we all know, even the most biomedically driven person, that people gain relief from non-prescription things and from non-surgical interventions. And so people have known this forever and started studying this more. Initially it was done a lot in people who had cancer. It was initially the kind of what we used to call it was complementary and alternative medicine. Complementary means you do the biomedical treatment and this complements the treatment. So this is like if you're getting chemotherapy, that maybe you're also getting massage and lymphatic drainage, you know, after your breast cancer surgery. Maybe you're getting, you know, put on a specialized diet for when you take your chemo so that your chemo is more optimized or the drugs work better, those kinds of things, versus alternative medicine, which is things that have doing something instead of something. So for example, and this is something that I do not recommend or practice, so just to be very clear, is if you have metastatic breast cancer and instead of getting the standard of care treatment, you decide to just only take high dose CBD or prayer or something like that. So that would be an alternative to the biomedical treatment instead of a complement to it. So integrative medicine is really, this is my own definition, but it takes, from all kinds of different ways of learning. So, you know, you learn about culture, religion, anthropology, traditions, different types of medicine, what we define as medicine and healing and all different kinds of cultures and people, you know, imagining the future of what medicine looks like and what care looks like. And, thinking about identity, thinking about suffering and all these things together, and then looking at everything that we know in humankind that has been used for these things, and really kind of trying to learn about the most common ones and understand them and be able to bridge that conversation between people who practice biomedical medicine and then people who maybe don't have special training in this, like patients who come to us or friends who ask us about treatments that they read on the internet. And I think in this age of misinformation and fast information as well, that and things looking really real, like I can tell you stories about things I've believed about, you know, like that are not true because it looked really real to me on the screen. And so it's so easy to get sort of tricked by that. So my job is to kind of learn about all these new things that are suggested and known and be able to advise people on it and be able to help biomedical practitioners understand what is available and what is the evidence behind certain things, if things can be harmful, how much things generally cost, if there are people in the area who perform different things that might be questionable, but that are, you know, generally more recommended. So those kinds of things. So kind of bridging all that knowledge together. And another part of it is just spending quality time with people. And we're able to do that because some of us are trained in acupuncture. Some of us are trained in different kinds of modalities, meditation. And so things can be built for that. And that's of course not something that like that people think about, but there are many different things we can incorporate into that. And then if we're able to practice in a palliative care or an integrative medicine environment or a hospital environment like I work in, then I'm able to bring all that knowledge to the table. And sometimes it's very helpful for helping people get through different crises and approaching their illness.
Well, I know for me, it really was those, I guess we would call them alternative therapies that really made the difference in healing from my Lyme disease, because at the late stage that I was at, you know, 13 years in, there wasn't much other than maybe IV antibiotics on like a continuous basis that was really going to do anything. So I found the acupuncture and energy medicine herbs homeopathy, like those things were like super helpful to me. And also doing like I always approach things from this holistic perspective of mind, body, emotions, and spirit, and doing that work. And maybe you can comment on how important that is as well, because there was, you know, there were things in my history. There was unresolved trauma. There was just a lot of chaos growing up, a lot of like repressed emotions and things I had taken on from my parents and all that. That was very much an underlying factor in my body's ability to fight off, you know, these different infections. Can you speak to that piece, you know, the more psychological aspects?
Yeah. So first, I just want to address that you mentioned that you mainly did alternative, and then you mentioned things that I consider just be integrative. So I think the whole thing is that these definitions are moving and they change from person to person, you know, based on what you think evidence is. I was trained as a scientist, so I think I have a little bit more of a rigorous definition, but there are great studies that show that acupuncture has benefit and that Reiki and massage therapy and all those things have benefit. Mainly when I think about alternative medicine, just so that you know, is I don't necessarily, it's just a word for me that is sort of an antiquated word. I think we should be using the word integrative. And then there are some things that that we know have benefit, and there are some things that we know do not. And what we really look to say, and every doctor does, no matter every kind of practitioner rather, does this, is they want to see if there's harm to what they're doing to you, if it costs a ton of money, if it could cause damage, pain, or if the, you know, those kinds of things are what people should be thinking about when they're doing a treatment. But just to kind of address that, and thank you for sharing about your journey with Lyme. And I think another thing to just say about Lyme and other diagnoses, and we might talk about this later, is that it's really, it's really, and we'll come back to this later, but if people are having things going on with them and you're a practitioner, whether or not you believe that their conclusion is correct or not, that's not really the point of you being there. The point of you being there is to be a witness to this person sharing what is causing their suffering, to validate it, and to try to come up with a plan that works with their reality, their perception of reality, in order to help get them to a place where they have more peace. Mm-hmm. It's not about you as the practitioner being right about getting the right diagnosis, or this thing isn't real, this thing isn't real. Things change. Things change, and don't bet on anything, because things we used to think weren't bad for us. I mean, when my mom was pregnant with my sister, they told her to smoke. Okay. Like, you know, it's the world changes. Don't double down on anything, because we're going to find out we're wrong. If you want to address that, you can, and then I'll talk about psychological things from past trauma.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm fully with you. I my dad was a doctor, and he sat in his office and smoked cigarettes as he's telling his patients, hey, you should probably quit smoking. Yeah. Let me tell you about that. So I fully get it. And thank you for the correction in terminology, because when I first was starting on my journey, it was still CAM, complementary and alternative medicines. And I you're right. The verbiage is shifting. And I love mm-hmm. integrative, because I like that term, because to me it integrates like mm-hmm. East and West, and traditional and innovative, and mind, body, spirit, and all of that. So I love that term, and I'm going to start using that more. So thank you. Yeah.
And just like we want our practitioners to be open-minded to our experience, I really encourage anyone that comes to any kind of practitioner to be open-minded to their experience. And that means that even if you're set on doing something all natural or whatever, you know, I'm not knocking any of this. Some people come in and they're like, I only want things from the earth. And I'm like, well, all these chemotherapeutic agents come from plants. So would you take those? You know? So I think being open-minded to what the history of the physician that you're, or the any practitioner really, that you're asking for help from their reality, because those things can help you. And so I think really the thing about integrative IL life is just open-mindedness and coming. If I'm going to be open-minded to you, then just be open-minded to me. You don't have to do it. But if someone comes to me and they have stage 4 breast or stage 2 breast cancer, and they're a mom, and they want to do, you know, they want to cure their breast cancer by, you know, eating oranges, I'm going to have a conversation with them about that. You know, that's, you know, not what I would recommend. And I would hope that they would be able to hear me a little bit. But back to the part you said about past trauma and how past trauma and things affect you. So I did a postdoctoral fellowship in epigenetics, and that is how things are passed down to us, not just through our DNA code directly, but modifications made to our DNA by external stressors. So that means one popular example that all of us know of is during World War II, we at least all know that World War II existed, maybe. Parts of people who lived in Holland were cut off from food. It's called the Dutch Hunger Winter. And those people were starving. And starvation is a very intense stress for our body. And our body makes a lot of changes and doesn't make certain things as much as it usually was. So it turns things off. And one of the ways we can do that is by methylating, you know, DNA. And to not get too complicated, basically what we see in not only the children, but the grandchildren of these survivors, who survived at least to have progeny or children, this is a scientist word, sorry, is that they have higher rates of different diseases, including mental illness, diabetes, and other sort of stress-related diseases like that. So we know that the trauma and the stressors that we're surrounded by and There are several great people out there who have written wonderful books. The Myth of Normal that just came out by Gabor Mate. Please correct me on the pronunciation.
Yep, you're correct.
Okay. And The Body Keeps the Score by
Besser van der Kolk.
Van der Kolk. Okay. Yep. Those are great books. There's a whole lot of books in our book. We wrote a book. I don't know if we talked about that yet.
We're going to.
We have a whole resource section of other books to read about trauma. My Grandmother's Hands, Racialized Trauma and the Pathway to Mending Our Hearts and Bodies, by Mina Kim. And then, you know, even a more kind of a pop book, What Happened to You? Conversations on Trauma, Resilience, and Healing with Oprah Winfrey and Dr. Bruce Perry. You know, so there's a lot of great books out there. I'm not going to try to sort of summarize it all, but yes, being when we're children, and I have a 15-month-old right now, everything I do, I'm so aware, is affecting her body and how she is going to react to everything. And some of those memories get stored forever. And that's how you react or go back. That's your coping tool for how you deal with certain situations because of what you were shown repeatedly as a child. And even things that I think, you know, might be trauma with a lowercase t, like just, you know, people not addressing things, right? People not talking about sensitive subjects to people. I think that those kinds of things can greatly affect us, affect how we interact with people, affect how we think about people, and can make us sick by, you know, essentially getting us in behaviors that can affect our stress levels. So for example, if we always avoid a situation and, like, for example, whenever my daughter cries, I offer her food, which is, I don't know, we'll see how it works out for her. But, you know, it's sort of associating those two things together, and she might eventually eat and make herself sick. I don't think there's a whole lot of evidence behind that or something like that. But I think about those things, you know, as a mom who's not, I don't have any expertise in child development and what actually affects you. But what I do know is that we don't know how much things affect people. We're all individuals. We're all susceptible at different levels to different perturbations. And it takes a long time to kind of unpack that. But what it leads to is lack of or poor coping skills in how to approach or deal with issues in life. And that definitely affects your stress load and the, you know, which directly increases your inflammation or decreases it, you know, depending on what's going on.
Right. And speaking of inflammation, that what I'm finding more and more is that that seems to be, science seems to be finding that inflammation is kind of root cause or correlated with just about every mental health or physical health issue there is, right? That's the latest, it seems.
Yeah, and I think that you know, we have a whole chapter on our book on inflammation, and I think, and I'm trying to find it right now, and I think that the you know, the big thing with inflammation is that what we see is that we can see markers in response to stress. And I think we're sort of in the earlier stages of really understanding it. I mean, surely when you're super septic, that means infected, or you're having a heart attack, or you're having a really bad inflammatory, like rheumatic disease or something like that, these markers are going to be super high. But sometimes they're lowly elevated, and there's a whole lot of other things in those pathways that can be elevated as well. And I think, you know, in the past 10 years, there have been multiple studies that have come out in mental health, you know, about different neurological and mental health diagnoses that are associated with some of these inflammatory markers. And so it's interesting. I think it's a, you know, I do think there is something about inflammation. I think that it's an important concept to understand and to learn about. And I think it's going to be something that we continue to talk about, but certainly wasn't a part of the conversation about my illness when I was younger. I didn't even know what that meant, except, like, you know, if you get a boo-boo and it's inflamed.
So tell us about your book. I'm excited to have you share with us, and what inspired you to write it, and what is it, you know, you're wanting to educate people on and convey with some of the themes of the book?
Yeah. So this is our book here. I've dog-eared a couple things for me to talk about. But it's called Long Illness, A Practical Guide to Surviving, Healing, and Thriving. And it's written by myself and Dr. Juliet Morgan, who has been on this podcast before. Check out her podcast. I'm not sure what it's about, but I'm sure it's awesome. She's wonderful. She trained in psychiatry and neurology. And so we have different training paths that have come together to help us provide this book. And so this is an evidence-based integrative medicine inspired handbook for people who are living with or affected by a long illness. So caretakers, caregivers, however you define yourself, you know, parents who are taking care of their kids who have something, you know, I feel like we all become a caregiver at some point in our lives, most of us, or become sick. So I think there's a broad appeal for this book. And basically we wrote this book because we want to be able to give you, help you build your own recovery toolkit. So you can kind of help organize yourself and like, how do I approach these different symptoms and things that are distressing to me? And how do I best treat myself? By learning from your past experiences and kind of, we have journaling and we have different types of plans you can make in here to kind of try it, do trial and error and see what works for you. The book's also to help you reclaim your identity, which is something that's really eroded and lost and not really talked about in the whole illness experience that we talk to, especially doctors don't really get any training on patient identity, or human individual identity and how that affects how you interact with your care. Also how to manage your symptoms and then how to be empowered and get the care that you deserve. And in the book, we talk about foundations of long illness, what it means for your life, how to work with your medical team, how to build your medical team, how to get the care you need, common symptoms like pain, fatigue, headaches, difficulty breathing, digestive issues, insomnia, all more, lots more than that, you know, a lot about mental health, lots of aspects of mental health, the long illness, how to manage that together, and a wide range of accessible healing techniques like CBD, traditional Eastern medicine, mindfulness practices, and emerging therapies. And then also we talk about long-term solutions and the road ahead. And so, yes, why we wrote this book. Mm-hmm. So we were in training, in integrative medicine training, and the pandemic hit. I was working in the hospital organizing a support for families whose family member were in the ICU in the very beginnings of COVID, and they were not able to communicate. You know, at that time we wore full costumes and to see everybody and we didn't let anyone near each other. And so we were trying to connect those. And because of that, I had a lot of patients who had COVID who would want to come see me in my clinic, my primary care clinic, and my integrative medicine clinic. And what I noticed that after people were sick, either if they had a mild illness or a severe illness, so if people had a severe illness, then they had, sort of this post-ICU, post-hospitalization, deconditioning, you know, once you have a major illness, like it makes sense to have a long recovery time. And that's seen for a lot of illnesses. But what we saw, people who had mild cases, who were able to stay at home, maybe had a little bit of breathing difficulty, were talking to me 2-3 months later and were saying, my toes are blue. And I'm getting all these emails and I'm just like, what is this stuff? You know, like, I can't think at work. I'm really tired. I don't feel as smart as I used to. I'm forgetting things. I'm dizzy. I feel like I'm going to faint all the time. And initially our responses as practitioners, is to say, hey, you just were sick. You're going to get better in a couple months. It's fine. This is what happens after you get sick. It's fine. It's fine. It's fine. And when I would ask my leadership what to say, you know, I would always validate people and I say, I'm sorry you're struggling. Let's make an appointment to see you in 2 more weeks. Like, here are some things you can work in to like increase your parasympathetic tone, like, you know, help you be able to relax easier and de-stress easier, and thinking of ways that they could cut back on certain things to give themselves a little more time to rest. But it just seemed to be a bit of healthism, or kind of, you know, like wellnessism, of like just being like, just eat healthy and do the right thing and you'll just get better, because that's what happens. And I just felt like I was selling people a bill of lies. Mm-hmm. And then I was like, man, this just feels like how people used to talk to me when I was like really sick and would just say, if you could just get all your shit together. Oops, sorry, Kest.
No, you can say it. Nope. We don't censor here. You can say whatever curses you want.
Yeah, like
my show.
You can just get everything in your life together.
Yeah.
Then you'll be fine. Right. And it's like, that's not how this works, you know? So I think, and then also, you know, everyone's anxiety was heightened. Even the most calm, rational people were like, what is going on? You know, like the cities were dead, you know? So I felt like we were doing people a disservice by minimizing their symptoms. And so we decided to start this group for long COVID, people who identified as having long COVID. And that time was called long haulers, people who just kept having symptoms. And these are people who, and I'm not saying that you have to be a certain person to be heard, but they come from all walks of life. They were doctors, they were teachers, they were homemakers, they were high schoolers, they were middle schoolers, they were all ages, genders, races, backgrounds, cultures, religions. No one was untouched by this. COVID deniers joined our group later. So it touches everyone. And when we started that group, what we really realized is that these people were, we were experiencing a mass disabling event in our culture, our culture is very ableist. They're very unfriendly to disabled people. Only in very recent history have we even had any protections for people who are disabled. And that includes a lot of people, or most people, who have a chronic or long illness. And coming to terms with that en masse is just a totally bizarre thing. And I'm very looking forward to the future when historians and people kind of discuss this, because I think it's really going to change a lot of things. It basically, COVID in general, showed that there was a problem with our rapid ability to respond to illnesses like this, with limitations of care if we have a fast pandemic. And then the other weakness it showed is our ability to care for people who have not straightforward illnesses that sort of affect their quality of life in this low kind of vague way. We don't have a great model to help these people thrive. And now that we have millions of people who are now either permanently disabled because they have lung scarring or, you know, other, you know, loss of limb, loss of, you know, brain function, you know, people have suffered tremendous injury, even to those who can just no longer do their job because they can't focus. I think it's really changing some of the conversation, and I'm hopeful that this very unfortunate event is going to help change the healthcare system and is going to help change our narrative around how we think about ability and disability and illness. But what we got a little bit of press, and we were in touch with an agent. I wanted to provide a workbook for these people. And then we basically took our story to people and talked to them about it. And they were like, well, you know, what's actually interesting is that you said this was like all your other patients. Like, tell me more about that, you know? And so I think, you know, something that has been talked about in, you know, how with the Me Too movement, with talking about race more, I think some of the things in the last decade have made it possible for us to have discussions about illness and disability. I think there's a whole lot of work that's been done in the last 40 or 50 years to make way for us to be able to have these conversations and to be able to react to the pandemic in the way that we did. Now we're able to, you know, we're starting to talk about things like how people are treated of different races, how people are treated of different genders or presenting genders in different medical settings, how treatment is different, you know. So a lot of these things have come out in the last 10 to 20 years that have really given us something to build on and talk about, and have really helped us in how we approach people with chronic illness. And now that more of physicians and everything and practitioners tend to be more diverse, I think that's also helping how we think about giving care to people who have illness. So we started to write this book to provide a handbook for people who, you know, a place to start with a lot of different symptoms and everything, to go for them to review different things they might not have thought about in the past, building on all of this, these different cultural things that have been happening in our society over the last couple of decades, to help give them a leg up, you know. And, you know, I really wrote this for my 20-year-old self, because if I would have had this book, it would have saved me a lot of heartache and a lot of trudging. And I mean, I think we all thought we were alone for a really long time. I think it's a pretty common part of development. But I think people who have, you know, these nebulous symptoms and everything, they feel alone for a very long time, because we don't have a really good way of how we talk to people about it as practitioners or as our friends, you know. We're very dismissive as people just because of our ableist culture and the way that illness is talked about in this country, in our society, and what's valued in a person.
I'm fully 100% agreeing with you on this. I felt very alone for the majority of the time that I was sick, which was almost 20 years. And, you know, friends and family didn't understand why I would be enthusiastic about making a plan. Yes, let's go do this fun thing. And then at the last minute, I'd be like, I'm not up for it. I don't feel well, you know, I can't. Mm-hmm. And they just didn't understand. You don't look sick. You don't, you know, like what's wrong with you is basically that thing. And why can't you just like get up and get better and do these things? And there is a real lack of understanding and a feeling of aloneness. So this kind of brings me to two things I wanted to look at with you. And you mentioned the word identity, and I'd love for you to say more about that. And then the power of healing, like within community, and how important support is for anybody who's struggling with long illness or any kind of health condition.
Yeah. And I think, you know, with identity, there's a couple of things. Well, first, I mean, I like to think about how the world sees sick people, and especially, you know, how that kind of influences how we think about things. I think the narrative that we have, and I'm kind of looking in the book to this, is that, you know, we kind of hear this story, you know, that we're told in books that I've read, not all books, but a lot of books, and, you know, movies, TVs, you know, they don't have a lot of time. In an hour, someone has to get a disease, get better, overcome it, you know, all those kinds of things. But what you see is this beautiful story where a vibrant person experiences a change in their body that limits them. No one knows how to help. A hero figure steps in, solves the problem, and then they live happily ever after. And we want to believe these stories. We've romanticized illness, just like we've romanticized like love and everything else. Like the reality of it is not a pretty picture. It's not something you can put a bow on. It's real ugly. It's weird and difficult to navigate. And, you know, I think that our current biomedical system of care has developed around these myths of what a sick person looks like, of what it means to be sick, of your worth in society. And so, you know, you have all these stereotypes, and that's a way that you learn too. I mean, when you're little, you learn that pumpkins are orange. And then when you get older, you realize that pumpkins can be a lot of different colors and you just didn't know it. But we learn by stereotyping things. And then part of the next stage of learning is learning that those were stereotypes to help you learn and to try to broaden your mind. But sometimes people don't go that far, I guess, in their learning. But I think that identity is something that, you know, at the first experience of an illness, you can feel like you're becoming that disease or the symptom. It's so overwhelming. And your reality is just totally warped. And I think no doctor to me ever was like, you're having issues with your identity and like who you are as a person now. No one ever sat down and just sort of like talked to me about it. But as I read about it, and as I also experienced patients sort of navigating these things, you know, it's just like anything else. You know, people reject things, accept things. Some people are enriched by it. Some people are completely engulfed by their experience, and it defines every part of their life. And we all kind of go through stages of that back and forth, and we try to get to a healthy point in it. But the truth is like change is really hard, and we need to be given support while we're kind of navigating these changes in our identity. And so, yeah, I'll pause there and let you ask the question.
Well, and I work in addiction treatment and I specialize in trauma, and I often do hear people, you know, using that language. I am an addict. I am depressed. I am a victim. I am my trauma. And how dishonoring that is of the rest of, no, you're a whole person, and you're a person who's experienced these things, and maybe many of them have been painful, but you're not your disease. You're not your trauma. You're not a victim, or at least not from my perspective. And I really try to empower people to look past those labels and past, you know, this identity. And what if identity is also something that's not fixed? You know, what if it's something that changes, and yep. that you can actually change it? It's not something that happens to you.
And I think to know also, you know, your diagnosis is not fixed.
Right.
I mean, my diagnosis has changed so many times, like in different ways, you know, not like, you know, not significantly in some ways, in other ways, very significantly, because medicine changes, because what we know changes, because how we categorize things changes. We all are constantly moving beings in flux. We're not static. In that one point, you know, you can say that you're those things, but you don't know what you're going to be tomorrow. And you were somebody else 5 years ago. And I think a lot of medicine, especially at UCSF and where I've trained, has been very trying to change the way we talk about people. So, you know, things that some people think are really stupid, like calling people by the right pronouns. And I'm not saying that that's a stupid thing. I'm saying that, like, there are some people, I happened to go onto Twitter the other night, which I never do, and I had no idea about people's ideas about illness and what they did, what the people who are out there. I guess I'm kind of naive to that, but, you know, we need to use person first language. We need to say a person living with,
right.
you know, this who uses a wheelchair, you know, not like a handicapped person. Like, that's not who that is, right? And like, right. not saying an addict, saying a person who uses drugs, a person who has a substance use disorder,
right.
a person experiencing homelessness, experiencing marginal housing, you know. And I think it's because these things are transient. And, you know, I had a difficult childhood. I experienced marginal housing, but no one would look at me right now and think that ever. I'm a doctor, I have a house, you know what I mean? Like, it's you're not fixed. And I think if you would have gone back and looked at me in high school, I think no one would have ever guessed I would be here right now. And it is really damning when you think about yourself in those ways. And I think that we all need to liberate ourselves from labels. And I think we need to liberate ourselves from diagnoses and our dependence on them for our identity. I do think diagnoses can be super useful for both yourself and other people. So we can communicate and say, I have cancer. I have heart failure. So people kind of know what's going on with you and kind of what to expect. But it doesn't really tell the whole, it doesn't tell everything. It barely kind of scrapes the surface for most people. And people kind of misunderstand why you're telling them that information. So I think, you know, especially with these diseases that are more nebulous, like autoimmunity, immunodeficiencies, you know, things that are a little bit more nebulous or rare, I think it's better to kind of say, you know, especially with autoimmunity, what I say to people is, you know, you have an autoimmune disease. Right now, we call it lupus. And we are going to treat you as that, because the way that we look at the tools we have right now to look at it show us that these treatments and these screenings are the best things for you. That might change and evolve over time as we learn more. Or you have autoimmunity. You have some different positive tests and you have symptoms that kind of fit in with an autoimmune picture, yet you don't meet any of the requirements for one of the diagnoses that we have, but we'll continue to monitor you and wait. I think that those are better ways to talk to people. People love diagnoses though, but the issue is that then people will be treated inappropriately when they don't meet the burden of disease to get the treatment, right? So the treatments for all these diseases range very significantly. And I think, you know, if you're predisposed or you have some of these markers, you might be more likely to develop certain things in the future. And so maybe it will make you take better care of yourself. Just like if someone has high cholesterol, they might want to think about eating healthier. They might want to think about making sure they go get tested to see if they need to be on a statin, those kinds of things. But not to immediately say, like, I'm going to need a quadruple bypass. You know, like, that's not what people think about that. But with these diseases that are more nebulous, you know, it's really hard because they're not getting a lot of feedback. And then people, because they tend to happen to women, I think, they are told that they're not that important, where if you have a heart attack, that's really important, right? But how is a heart attack any different than having lupus? I mean, you know what I mean? Like, which ones were, you know, bipolar versus cancer? I don't know. I mean, some people would pick the cancer, right?
Yeah.
It's all in the eyes of the person.
What a rich conversation here. But as our time is starting to come to a close, Megan, first tell us, where can people get the book? Is it out yet? And where can they get it? And where can they find you if they want to talk with you or work with you?
Yeah. So, Long Illness is published by Hachette. So it's available on the Hachette website. It's also on Amazon, bookstore.org. It's on sale for 25% off right now at Barnes & Noble's for pre-order. It comes out May 9th, which is next Tuesday from today when you got from now, and it will be out.
It'll be out by the time this comes out. Yes.
Yeah. There is an audiobook, and it's also being released in the UK under Penguin Random House. I think the release date is very similar. Not sure exactly. We haven't heard back yet. And you can, we have an Instagram page that just got made. It's @longillness. And we have a website that will be up hopefully by the time this comes out, longillness.com. So you can reach us there. And at some point soon, Dr. Morgan does not have any availability. She is all filled up with her psychiatric practice. But I have a private practice that is going to start accepting new patients soon. And so information will be there if you want to work on either your long COVID or long illness. And I'll provide you with some more information on the website that you can look at for other suggestions for long COVID and other resources.
Wonderful. Wonderful. And thank you so much for sharing your story and your experiences with us. I share your vision for the future, I think, with medicine. I love the direction you're going. I would love to see more doctors and treatment professionals going in this direction, because I think it is the wave of the future. Any final thoughts for us?
No, I would just say, keep trying. When you're suffering and you feel like you're being disenfranchised by the system, you will find someone like me, like Dr. Morgan, like you. And, you know, it's just like finding a friend. You got to keep looking. Somebody is out there who will hear you and help you. And it might not be a doctor. It might not be a nurse. It might be a chiropractor. It might be somebody. It might be a friend who's dealt with illness. But you will find someone, and just keep looking. Online communities are great places. Finding other people in your communities who have dealt with illness are great resources for people who are struggling, so they don't have to reinvent the wheel every time.
Yes. And to know that you are not alone in your struggles, right? There are other resources, many resources and people out there who do get it. So thank you so much, Megan, for being with us today. Thank you so much, listeners and viewers. If you've made it this far, so grateful to you. If you've liked this podcast, please do share it, comment, like, subscribe, rate it, all the things that you do to help get it out there in the hands of more people. And I'm Dr. Adriana Popescu signing off. Thanks again for tuning in to Kaleidoscope of Possibilities. See you next time. Thank you for joining me for this episode of Kaleidoscope of Possibilities, Alternative Perspectives on Mental Health. This has been Dr. Adriana Popescu. If you enjoyed this episode, please like and subscribe and share with others. To find out more about me, my guests, and more, please visit my website at adrianapopescu.org. See you next time!